It's deja vu. This moment's happened before.
You have found the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Kaleidoscope Gallery, and the second in a new series called Conversations. In this installment, Kaleidoscope Gallery contributor Leah and myself, Paul, chat about airport facial recognition, the exploding Swiss tacos, imagining visiting any time or place in the past, examining recent evidence that life may indeed flash before our eyes before we pass on, and more. So let's get into this conversation inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Leave the phone off the hook. Teach the cat how to cook.
Be a man, not a mouse. Sell your car, rent your house.
Get away.
I love it here. I've got a little vine-covered cottage here in Palm Springs. I just had a kidney-shaped swimming pool put in, and I haven't been able to find any kidney-shaped people.
Welcome, welcome.
Yes, this is unusual for us. We are recording here on a Sunday, early evening, it's actually really bright and sunny. And we have to close the blinds. Like, Leah, you even have to wear sunglasses.
I'm wearing shades.
That's how bright it is, because normally it's like a nighttime vibe.
Yeah, this is a nice Sunday afternoon spring vibe.
Yeah, and we're sipping on some bourbon.
Here's the clink.
Yeah, there's the ice cubes. Now, however, we have just returned from a trip that we were in a combination of Mexico and...
The Baja Peninsula.
In Mexico, and then Palm Springs. Palm Desert.
Mm-hmm, outside of Palm Springs.
And it was for obvious reasons, our first trip out of country in over 2 years.
As avid travelers, it was, yes, a long break.
Yeah. And we were visiting family as well as in Mexico, just...
Exploring a new place, getting a sense of an area I wanted to visit.
The Sea of Cortez.
Yeah, it's actually a desert area that abuts the ocean.
Well, yes, it's where the Pacific and the Sea of Cortez merge. It's the peninsula.
Yeah. But what was curious upon our return we were going from Mexico to Palm Desert in this case, and we had a strange routing because there's a lot less direct flights, again, for obvious reasons. And we ended up having to route our flight from Cabo San Lucas in Mexico to Salt Lake City, Utah, of all places. And then onwards to...
Got to see some snow.
And then where was it? Where did it connect to?
Palm Springs.
To Palm Springs Airport. And when we entered... Salt Lake City Airport. First of all, it was almost completely deserted.
Yeah, it was beautifully empty.
And what time of day was it again? Do you remember?
Evening.
It was
like 8:30 their time.
Okay. And when we were on the tarmac, and they're giving you the usual spiel. You know, if you're connecting, go through this way, and if you're just coming through the customs. And security, we should let you know that we have a new special facial recognition technology, so you won't need your passports. I was like, okay, that's strange. whatever. I never really thought much about it. I'm sure we're going to have to show our passport. But as we get to the, what is it exactly called? Border control area.
Mm-hmm.
There was no lineup whatsoever. So we just get whisked up to the desk and the guy just says, okay, can you sit there for a second while I take your photo?
Yep. Look into the camera. The Logitech.
A little webcam.
A little webcam.
So he took our photo and he said, okay, to me, he said, okay, you're good. He didn't ask for my passport.
No, just asked where we were going, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and that wasn't even noted. He didn't write that down or anything. And in your case, he just had to, he took your photo and just asked, what's your birth date? And then you said it gave you your birth date. It's like, okay, you're good to go. I guess he wasn't 100% sure on your picture, but the idea here is that all they did was literally just take a picture of us and I guess check it against the database and...
Yep. You are who you say you should be. You're in the database because you had to show your passport before you ever got on the flight.
Well, yeah, that's your theory. My theory is that when you get your passport, because I should mention
and that. They know where your ultimate destination is.
I should say that this is the first time I've traveled on a Canadian passport because I got my Canadian citizenship just before the pandemic started.
Two citizens.
Of UK and now of Canada. And so I'd never traveled on that passport, which is why it really surprised me that they didn't ever have to look at it. Because
you had to have a visa waiver before. It was a pain in the...
Yeah, and... what I figured is that when you get your photo for your passport, that photo goes onto your government's database. And then that database is clearly shared with, for example, the United
States. Border controls around the world as needed.
Sure. And all they're doing is taking your photo and then comparing the photo they just took to the photo they have on the database.
Yeah.
But it worked really well.
Yep. Yeah, but if they need the other details about your flight path or any of the rest of it, which they did ask where we were headed to ultimately. All of that's already been cross-checked by the airline.
But so. The process was extremely simplified.
Yeah, it was like 3 seconds. And then their security was simplified too, other than their scanning of your duty-free bottle. But they didn't make us take out liquids or any of those annoying things.
No, I just thought it was interesting how clearly this facial recognition process is, and it's the only time we encountered it.
Highly effective.
It's the only time we encountered it. So I have a feeling it's going to be, you know, they're going to start rolling it out everywhere. And, you know, there's a lot of issues around facial recognition, but we won't go there now. We'll probably talk about that with Autumn at some point.
Yeah, I have less trouble using it at a border than I do, you know, it being used without my knowledge in a public space or even in a private one without me consenting to it.
Yeah, that's a different kettle of fish, isn't it?
Yeah, like you go to someone's party and they're like facially recognizing you without telling you.
But travel, I mean, it's pretty awesome. I mean, I'm the kind of person still slightly in awe of jets and like, you know, just sitting, you know, albeit uncomfortably for a few 5-6 hours. But when you pop out, boom.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always amazed me that you in such short a period of time, you can be in a very different part of the world.
But you've traveled, you're a traveler, I would say, because you've traveled with your family when you were younger. And you've got lots of experience traveling. You encouraged me to really get into traveling because I was kind of like, well, it's an inertia thing. Once you're kind of settled where you are, you're maybe less inclined to get moving.
It's a thing you haven't done before. You don't know whether you like it or not, right? So,
For example, part of what makes you a traveled person is when you were in high school and in your last year of high school, you got to do something really, really cool, which is, why don't you describe it? You spent your last year of school in Switzerland.
Living abroad in the French-speaking part of Switzerland. Yeah, I got to live with an awesome family and go to a Canadian school and finish up my degree. But I also audited classes at the local high school. Really immerse myself in the culture and the language and bond with this wonderful family and meet friends from different parts of Canada and different parts of Switzerland. Swiss German. So when
you
say
you were living with a Swiss French family,
yeah,
and being immersed in their day to day lives and like helping wash the dishes,
Suisse romande, oui, tout ça. The town where the school is called Neuchâtel. Neuchâtel is more how it would be pronounced. There's a beautiful sing-songy.
In French, it is said as Neuchâtel, Neuchâtel, meaning in old French, Newcastle, Neuchâtel, Neuchâtel. So it'd be fine in English to say it as Neuchâtel, Neuchâtel, and now you know.
You show me Neuchâtel.
Yes, but I stayed in a town, a banlieue, like outside of Neuchâtel called Courtaillot. Yeah, it was beautiful. Beautiful place. And great experience. Very transformative. I was very privileged, to experience it.
But you told me about a story. You told me a story about that. When you're in school in Switzerland, you were given an assignment by the teacher to... make for other students to make a meal for other students that
Canadian
was in
food.
The Canadian or North American style.
Yeah.
Now, whatever that is.
I can't remember what we made. It was an exchange weekend and they were supposed to make something Swiss for us and we were supposed to make something Canadian for them. But of course, when you don't have maple syrup and you don't have Canadian bacon...
Canadians are big fans of maple syrup, and it appears the iconic pancake topping is popular with thieves as well. Police in Quebec are investigating after a major supply of the sticky stuff went missing from a warehouse northeast of Montreal. Louise Martin has all of those details. Mm. What happened, Louise? Yeah.
Sticky fingered thief, for sure. This was a huge haul of maple syrup that has gone missing, effectively stolen, worth up to some $30 million, according to officials. So...
Yeah, because, wait, let's see, because if you had to pinpoint, like, to someone who didn't live in Canada, someone in Europe, like you were, what do they think is Canadian food?
Mm-hmm. So that's it. That we, you know, if we were thinking Canadian, those were the things we thought about. There was, you know, you thought about poutine too, but cheese curds weren't going to be readily available. And, like, we didn't know how to make gravy. We were 17, 18 years old, but... So yeah, but there was two times where I was asked to do this. Yeah, I think we ended up making probably pancakes, but without maple syrup, how is it really Canadian? I mean, it's just like a bad crepe, you know, that's kind of thick. And anyhow, it was easy for the Swiss to make us something typically Swiss, which was something really popular from that area called tarte. And you can do it savory, you can do it sweet, but it really is like just a large baking sheet with a very thin crusted tart, open-faced.
So you said you made them pancakes, but I thought you said you made them...
Well, no, that was a different challenge I had. Oh. So the family I lived with asked me to make them a typically Canadian dinner. So that was another challenge. I'm like, first of all, I'm not a great cook. I don't really know how to cook. But then also, I'm a kid of immigrants. Like, you know, I don't even know what typically Canadian dinner would look like.
Maybe like a Thanksgiving dinner.
Well, this is it. And don't have the ingredients or the means to. I wasn't going to make a Thanksgiving dinner. So I was stumped this one. So I went to the Migros, which is like the local grocery chain, which is really well stocked, way more fun shopping even in grocery chains there. But so I'm looking and it was probably in the ethnic aisle or something that I found some like Taco Bell taco shells. I'm like, well, you know, that's kind of really North American food, and it is, you know, just like a North American take on Mexican food. But and I knew how to make it.
Are you talking about those taco kits?
It comes with the seasoning. And yeah, you just have to do all the toppings and, you know, mix it with meat and heat up the shells. And anyhow.
Oh, a party in a box.
Be careful. When you pass the old El Paso, you could start a party.
Pass the old El Paso. Taste the old Southwest. Pass the old El Paso. Taste our very best.
So, when you pass the old El Paso, be careful. You could really start a party.
Right, but if you understand Swiss culture, like eating a messy taco shell that breaks and explodes all over the place is not really, I mean, yeah, you eat with your hands things like fondue that are really neat and tidy, like, you know, well-engineered food. I think it was probably
well-engineered food. Okay. Cause the taco is a bit of an engineering disaster. Usually
the hard shell taco the soft shell is an engineering marvel, but the hard shell taco is an engineering disaster, especially for people who are inexperienced. And so it was a mess, and it was funny. It was genuinely funny to watch everyone eat this. But it was also, I think they were probably mildly horrified by the experience. Culturally assaulted.
It sort of perpetuates a sort of a stereotype about American / North American food that it's a bit gauche and a bit.
Probably, yeah. But also it was fun and funny.
It's sloppy.
Yeah.
I guess you could have, that's another thing. You could have made them sloppy Joes.
That's something I never would have eaten growing up. It was just not part of my palate.
Oh, sloppy Joes. But I mean, it's funny that you said that you went to the quote unquote ethnic aisle.
Probably. And, like, where else was I going to find
But that? Isn't that funny that when you went here in Canada, grocery stores, now they have changed a bit. But actually, I could just say that when we were in a grocery store recently in America, I saw the ethnic aisle.
Oh, yeah.
And in the ethnic aisle, it's just kind of a hodgepodge of like maybe a little bit of curry paste. Maybe some
Taco shells.
Well, it depends. Because it's quote unquote Mexican, and then some soy sauce.
Yeah, some oyster sauce. Maybe if it's really maybe, sriracha.
Yeah, and maybe Jamaican jerk sauce. Yeah,
maybe. But then in Toronto you have entire stores that are the whole thing is an ethnic. Every aisle is the ethnic aisle. 20 kinds of rice from 10 different countries.
Yeah. And that strikes me as more contemporary, whereas it seems a bit like in the past to have like an ethnic aisle. Could you imagine I've seen pictures or videos of what the quote unquote ethnic aisle looks like in other countries. So let's say you're in Britain and they might have an ethnic food aisle, or they have actually like an American food aisle. And that's where you can get your hot dogs, American cheese, giant tubs of ketchup, Kraft dinner. And then in Japan, it's big in Japan too.
But there's some things you just can't get. And so when I lived overseas for that year, and I did a debate team, an acting team sort of competition, and we were lodged with Americans living in, was that Vienna? I think it might have been Vienna. Anyhow, in a European city. They had sent to them and stockpiled in a special large storage room, not just a pantry, but like a large room. They had shelves and shelves of American products, of sweets and chips and, Doritos and whatever. Just all the stuff you were never going to find, even in the American ethnic aisle of their grocery stores. They would get, people sending them like box loads of this stuff, and they would have it there. Ready for them for their consumption.
It kind of reminds me. This is another travel story, obviously, but this is a couple of years ago, and we were in Spain, and we're coming, arriving at a train station, and a reasonable sized train station, not huge. And on the right hand side, we saw a Tim Hortons.
Yes.
But this Tim Hortons wasn't like the kind of Tim Hortons that you can also get in the States now, which is, by the way, for anyone listening, this is a ubiquitous donut / food
chain. It's a chain. Franchise that it was founded by a hockey player from Hamilton
named Tim Horton
in the 60s.
Yeah, late 60s, named Tim Horton. And it was like such a Canadian thing.
What is the first thing that comes to mind when I mention Tim Hortons?
Tim Hortons, medium with milk and double chocolate donut.
All right, everyone has their favorites, right? Well, tonight we are going beyond the coffee and donuts to meet the man behind the famous chain.
I suppose the only thing that could influence my retiring or giving up hockey would be that things are quite hectic these days, trying to combine business with hockey. And if the business that I am involved in continues as it is, I may have to consider retirement before I would like to.
That's the Tim Horton Donut Emporium?
Yes, Tim Horton Donuts Ward. And it's very nice of you to let me get a word in about it. I'd like to say thank you to all you nice people in the Hamilton and Burlington districts Galt and Brantford and Kitchener-Waterloo for enjoying the donuts.
We'd like to thank you for paying for our Hockey Night in Canada, too.
Enjoy the taste and flavor of a Tim Horton donut, the aroma of our coffee and the smile we save for you.
When you get the urge for freshly brewed coffee, freshly made donuts, head for your favorite donut shop, Tim Horton.
It's since been bought by the people that own Burger King or A&W, whatever, and it's a conglomerate, and it's somewhat expanded into the States, but it's the same.
And internationally.
Because this one in Spain was very much like playing up on the Canadian theme.
It was like a Canadian Starbucks. It looked way more, even the rebranded Tim Hortons in Canada, which is like a lot nicer looking than the old Tim Hortons. But this one looked kind of like, you know, it was all about the flag and the red. And it looked almost fancy, yeah.
And stylized drawings.
It was
moose.
A cafe. It wasn't a donut shop.
But it was definitely selling like the Canadian experience. It's interesting to see how other people view.
It was Canadiana cool.
Canadiana cool.
It was in the Alicante train station, and it was very much the. Wow, look at the Canadiana cool coffee cafe. Like,
yeah, and there was actually toques for sale, like woolen hats, which would be, of course, just a novelty in Spain. And this is a very hot part of Spain.
it would be an abomination to wear it. Yeah.
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Sticking with kind of a travel theme, but in this case, time travel. And we've got, I'm going to pose to you a question. It's quite open-ended, so.
Let's go there.
Okay, so step into your time machine. And you're going to be able to travel back to any time. And any place, but mainly any time. It could be a million years ago, 1,000 years ago, 10 years ago.
Yeah, it would be like, I'm trying to pick, but it would be some pre-colonial. I'm just trying to pick would it be like Bohol, where my mother's family was from.
Bohol in the Philippines?
Yeah, just to get a sense of like what life was like in a day-to-day basis before the Spaniards showed up.
Oh, okay.
But I'm equally curious about on the European side too, which was more Northern European, like, you know, Finns and Swedes and Scots.
I see. But what do you think?
Pre-Roman, what did that look like?
Oh, okay.
You know?
So in both cases, pre-colonial, going back to the pre-colonial times of your own ancestry.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think Bohol would have looked like, say, 1,000 or 800 years ago?
I think Bohol pre-colonial, from what I can tell, it was already intermixed. The indigenous culture was infused with some Islamic influences through the Javanese sort of Islamic spread, you know, empire of sorts. Plus, there had been Chinese trade and intermarriage for a long time. So it was already a mixed culture, and I think there were different indigenous, you know, groups there. One that I think they're still there, the Ascara, or I think they're called, or Iskaya. I think they came from another island. So I think it would have been, I think people probably lived in nipa huts, and there was probably some, you know, farming and gathering and lots of fishing.
So you would like to travel back to that time to experience it. So why? Why would you like to experience that?
It'd be interesting to, because that was not, that history is lost. And all you really kind of have is either a colonial take on what it looked like or what archaeologists and anthropologists have been able to piece together.
Right.
Or sometimes, you know, there's like, you know, there, yeah, other historians and other types.
So you could be a witness, a historical witness.
Yeah. So it, to be able to experience, and these were largely oral cultures, often. So to be able to experience what those cultures were about, firsthand and be part of them.
I've never thought of it that way. I looked at time travel as like going back to like the coolest part of history, that is something that you resonate with. Like for me, it'd be somewhere like in the Baroque era of music in Europe, because I love Baroque music and I always felt like a little connection to it. Yeah. I almost could imagine myself living in that time.
Yeah. To me, you're either part of the elite at that point, and you know, or I guess that you could have a patron, you know, that's sort of the middle class equivalent. If you were a really successful artist and you had patronage, then you could live decently, try to, that way. Other, or you were, you know, kind of a feudal, you know, the working class equivalent.
So it, like what you have to say about time travel, it would be convenient if you time traveled back to when you had some money.
I come back from moneyed.
You don't want to travel back to surf, like to become a serf in a feudal system.
Yeah, basically, well, which most people were.
But you're not really embracing the romance of the question.
Yeah, no, I get it. I do embrace the romance of the question, which why for me, it's way more interesting to go to the pre-colonial time where everyone's just umming and guessing versus the historical stuff that we know already. And I love Europe. I've spent a lot of time there, but you know, if I were going to go into like, you know, more modern history, it might not be in Europe. Like it, you know, it might be in China.
Wouldn't it be cool to go back to like to the moment when like the first song was written?
Yes, exactly.
Or
where language was born.
Yeah. The first play that was ever put on.
This is my point. This is the kind of thing I want to do. Like if I'm going to pick a time, it is. It's when was the first song? When were the first words spoken? Or, you know, because language maybe evolved out of kind of whistling and stuff like that. So yeah, when did that articulate into verbal language? Yeah. So anyhow, that kind of stuff is, you know, the first time fire was used, the first burial.
Like who invented fire? Like who invented the wheel? Like we owe them. We got to give them a pat on the back.
I would love to witness that moment. That would be fascinating.
That's interesting.
Yeah. That's my take on it. Cause yes, you know, I have been privileged to have traveled a decent amount and so history is really interesting and it's all around us. And I like to read it and, you know, oh, the architecture, the whatever, like when you notice things that are old, I like to do that. And
yeah,
I always wish I had, you know, that'll be neat for AR when like you can just sit there and look up. Okay. What
augmented reality?
Exactly. All right. What period is that architecture? Tell me the history of like this neighborhood or whatever.
Yeah, that would be cool. If you're walking down the street and with augmented reality specs on you, you could look at a building and then that building would vanish and the AR would come up and show you the original building that was there.
Yeah.
Or before there was any building.
Exactly. You could query all sorts of stuff and it would give you that information. That would be amazing as long
kind of
as it
was time traveling.
Yeah. If you're like walking expertise, you see a certain bug that you think is amazing. What bug was that? Those whales we saw leaping. What kind of whales were they? You know, I would love that, but just no advertising.
You are listening to the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
To kind of come to one of the concluding parts of this, which has been conversations kind of themed around.
Seems to have taken a travel theme.
Yeah, and journeying.
Yes.
Let's talk about the ultimate journey, which is life itself.
Row, row, row your boat.
Indeed. And you sent me a really interesting article. It was in BBC. And I'm going to pull it up here. And the headline is, life may actually flash before your eyes on death, new study. And what it is new data from a scientific accident has suggested that life may actually flash before our eyes as we die.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the summary of what this article is about is, how would you summarize that?
Well,
article?
I need you to summarize it because I read it a while ago. And so I'd like to remember what it said, but I do remember it saying,
well,
basically,
here's the gist. Then. Mm-hmm. A team of scientists set out to measure the brainwaves of an 87-year-old patient who had developed epilepsy. But during the neurological recording, he suffered a fatal heart attack, offering an unexpected recording of a dying brain. It revealed that in the 30 seconds before and after, the man's brain waves followed the same pattern as dreaming or recalling memories.
Yeah.
Now, you and I, we have talked in the Kaleidoscope Gallery about near-death experiences and what people who've had near-death experiences bring back to tell us about that experience. Here we have just one single case.
Yep.
Where they recorded the neurological functions as a person died. And it revealed a neurological pattern that is consistent with
recall
and dreaming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, what do you make of that?
Well, it is this notion that when you pass away, there's a your life, there's a simultaneous sort of the web of your life. You see it.
And it's also similar that it has similar, interesting that it has similar patterns to dreaming, which implies kind of a non-linear narrative, or, you know, dreams are always strange and not bound by physics as such.
Yeah, because you're not going to literally go through a chronological, you know, from the moment you took your first breath till you died memory of your life. That's just too linear to imagine. So it makes sense to me that it be recall combined with dream state, because then you can have a non-linear experience of your life.
And what's interesting here, the article points out that this process continued. This neurological process continued 30 seconds after the patient's heart stopped beating, the point at which a patient is typically declared dead. So this would be that transition between life and death, that 30 seconds that they measured. So let's say that the brain, the body, has provided us with this opportunity to have our life flash before us just before we die. My question is, why?
Well, it's like, why is there a conclusion in a story or a play or a essay? You know, it's because there's meaning to our lives, and there's it's the tapestry, you know, it's the...
But I wondered this. Is it to prepare you for something?
Probably.
After death?
I mean, if you think about
like
all
what would
of
be the...
the
purpose of it, just to sort of, as you say, like have a conclusion and the curtains come down and fini, the end? Or is it something that you could sort of take with you?
Well, there's always this notion of weighing, or, you know, karma and dharma. The heart being weighed, you know, or the being on the book of life list or not, you know, these different ways of talking about assessing. So what that all means, this I see these things as symbolic, but the consistency across cultures of that symbolism to your question of why give why have that recall and that understanding of the sort of the entirety of who you were in this lifetime, like whether you believe in multiple lifetimes or not, like in that lifetime. Why? Yeah, I don't know. But according to the symbolism that we have across cultures, there is some kind of, I don't want to use the word judgment, but like you're weighing, or, you know.
So I guess if you get
transition
to, like if you imagine yourself, I'll imagine myself, if I get 30 seconds summary of my life, what would it look like? I mean, hopefully for the most part it would look pretty fun.
Well, this is the power of the choices that we make.
Lots of laughter. What's that, Leah?
It's the power of the choices that we make. And it, you know, our life is comprised of so many moments.
Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
So are your moments regretful, or are they, you know, have they been shaped by things that are true or false? And we live in a world that questions truth kind of constantly at this point. But even if you take a relative definition of truth, even if, you know,
let's say if like reincarnation was true, and this is like completely speculative, like I really don't know how I feel. Would this be like a kind of like, oh, you're like, if you had an album of past lives, and this would go in, this would be the 32nd sort of summary that would go into, you know, snapshot of life number 3 or 50 or whatever it was.
If there's something I have noticed in this lifetime, it's that there's these like intergenerational patterns that are pretty astounding. And so does that mean that there's like lives, you know, life after death?
Well, if there was life after death, this 30 seconds before you finally kick off and bring with you kind of your calling card, or, oh my God, a report card. And like, you have to, is that like, you know what I mean? Is that your, like your signature? Like, oh yeah, like, that's how we identify you. Like, or is it simply just like you were talking about earlier, just like the last curtain call and the curtain falls and the lights go down.
Yeah. Or there's another, yeah. If there's another thing, these are the things that, like, you know, have an influence over you.
The only issue is that like the only people that know this are people who are no longer with us. So I'll do my best. And if I go before you, Leah, I will do my best to send a postcard from the edge.
I think everybody says that.
And it doesn't really work out. Or maybe through archetypes and symbols.
Exactly. It's through the inner voice. It's through archetypes and symbols. And, you know, as someone who lost someone very close, like, yeah, those transition periods, pay close attention to them, especially in the first 9 and 40 days.
And speaking of transitions, we're gonna conclude our conversation for today. That was fun.
Mm-hmm.
I should mention to listeners that we are still working on our deep dive into 70s and 80s stuntman on the threshold of life. You know, since we're talking about life and
Yeehaw,
death.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's going to be really interesting. But this was a fun, like...
conversation.
Yeah, I pray traveling. But yeah, so, okay. And I guess until next time, Leah.
Until next time, Paul.
Okay, cheers.
Thanks.
You have been listening to the many colors of the Kaleidoscope Gallery.